Hi, folks. Next up is This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. My co-host Evan Brown is here. And we have incredible guests today, Eric Goldman and David Green. We're going to talk about creative challenges to NSA surveillance, taking Chubby Checker on a trip to the islands, the proposed federal shield law getting better while California's net legislation is getting worse. Much more than that coming up on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 230, recorded October 4th, 2013, the 230 Birdie. Hello, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Evan, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Denise? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. This is my co-host, Evan Brown, of course, for those of you who may be new to the show. Evan, I am just kind of blown away and stunned that we've managed to pull off today's episode in the way that it came together.
You're right. Yeah, there is a certain order to the universe, and here it is perfectly manifested, episode 230. And yeah. You know, look at our guest list. Isn't it awesome?
Yeah, we try and provide great legal information, cutting edge issues relating to technology and the law. But I think that this week we are actually providing proof of order in the universe, as you say, Evan. Because here on episode 230 of This Week in Law, we have serendipitously booked our never not awesome, one of our favorite guests, Professor Goldman, to join us today. Hello, Professor Goldman.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fabulous. I feel like this show is just, you know, the universe is smiling on it because we did not intentionally plan to have you on episode 230. If I had given it a moment's thought, we certainly would have planned to have you on episode 230. I don't know if we can just thank our delightful intern, Sandow, for making this all come together, but I think he was pretty oblivious to it, too. He'll have to let me know if otherwise. And we have tons of great cases and developments around Section 230 to talk about today. So go figure. Can't imagine love how it all came together, but yeah, love it, too. Always great to have you on the show. And also joining us today, as if that weren't enough, we have first-time guest David Green, who has newly joined the Electronic Frontier Foundation just in August, right, David?
July.
There we go. So just a few months into his turn with the EFF. Folks who have watched and listened to the show over the years will no doubt remember the Andrew Bunner DCSS case in which a litigant took a case all the way up to the California Supreme Court on the issue of whether or not it was okay for him to publish DCSS, the CSS DVD encryption, decryption code, on his website. And went back and forth with the courts on that. And David here argued the case and briefed it to the California Supreme Court, and was pivotal in the outcome there, which was a wonderful First Amendment decision that Andrew could, in fact, publish DCSS on his site because DCSS was everywhere at that point at the time he published it and it couldn't have been a trade secret under California's trade secret law. So thanks for that, David, and thanks for sure. All the great, great work that you've done over the years. It's wonderful to have you on the show.
I'm really happy to be here. My first time on TWIL.
Yes. So let's start out looking at some work that David is doing at the EFF, and it is on the privacy. Actually, it's on the First Amendment front with definite privacy-related overtones. So we have mentioned your First Unitarian case on the show before, David. First Unitarian Church versus the NSA. In the wake of the Edward Snowden leaks and the information that has come out there. This has been a fascinating case that EFF has filed, challenging NSA surveillance, not on privacy grounds here, although I think you guys have thrown a lot into this lawsuit, but primarily on First Amendment grounds, under right of association principles. Now, in going through the case and the arguments that are being asserted here, David, I've had a few sort of reactions, some things that come to mind as characterizations of EFF's case here. And I want to throw them at you and see, sure, you know, what you think about them and which one, if any, accurately sort of captures the zeitgeist of the case. One is the Hail Mary pass. So much has been tried to challenge the constitutionality of the Patriot Act provisions that this one seems like, okay, we're going to just throw it up there and see how it goes. The other is throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. And then the final one, and this may be the most apt, is getting Al Capone on tax evasion charges. So,
oh my. I hope it's actually none of those. I think that, okay, the First Amendment ground is a really important ground that hasn't really, it's been raised in other cases, but hasn't really been fully emphasized the way we hope to emphasize it. You know, we do have a lot of things going on in the litigation. We have three main grounds. I should say, just backing up a bit, that what this case focuses on, what it challenges specifically, is the NSA's bulk collection of telephone call metadata. So that's what we're learning a lot about various things the NSA collected. But what our lawsuit is about is the telephone metadata collection, where the records of every single phone call made within and from and to the United States is being collected by the NSA and retained for 5 years. So that's what our lawsuit challenges. And we have three grounds for challenging that. One is that the practice isn't authorized by the statute, which the NSA is relying on. And then we have two constitutional challenges. One is the First Amendment challenge, and we do have a Fourth Amendment challenge as well. But the First Amendment challenge, it's much more than just, you know, taking a flyer on it. We think it's a really serious argument that hasn't been addressed yet and needs some attention from the courts.
Yeah, absolutely. When we get down to the test, you know, the when you finally look at a statute and see if it's too broad and if its interests are going to counteract those of the First Amendment, which provides the tension here. Can you describe what that test will be in this case for our audience who may not be constitutional scholars?
Yeah. So what we have to show here is that this program, by collecting this data, the NSA is violating the First Amendment associational rights of the plaintiffs in the case, of our clients in this case, and we're doing that by our claim based on Supreme Court precedent is that when groups of people get together for the purpose of expressing themselves, they have rights to do that anonymously. They have rights to do that without revealing who they are. And this law goes way back to 1956, a case dealing with the NAACP, where the state of Alabama was trying to revoke the NAACP of Alabama's ability to operate as a nonprofit organization in that state. And during the course of that lawsuit, they asked the NAACP to produce its membership lists. And the NAACP wouldn't do that. And that single issue, whether the NAACP could be compelled to produce its membership list, went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this U.S. Supreme Court said, no, they couldn't, that they have a First Amendment right as an association, and people have a right to associate that with them anonymously. And that if you require an organization to disclose who its members are, then you're going to inhibit them from participating and being members of the organization. So that's the basic First Amendment right. And we're saying that by disclosing who's calling you and who you're calling, that this is the equivalent of disclosing membership lists and disclosing people with whom you associate. So that's the First Amendment right. Once we prove that, the burden's then going to go to the government to show that this program and I'm going to simplify this a bit, but that this program is a necessary program and that it's only collecting the information that it really needs to. We're going to look for this being a narrowly tailored program that is infringing on associational rights only to the extent that is really necessary to do so. And that's where we really feel that we can prevail in this case, because they're collecting everything. and they're admitting that a lot of what they're collecting is irrelevant and they'll never actually use it for any investigative purposes, but they're collecting everything because they claim that it's just easier and more efficient for them to collect everything than to get the information as they discover a need for it.
So this may not be your job as an advocate, but at some point a judge is going to reflect on, well, how could a more narrowly tailored regime be in place and still serve the strong government interest of national security? And that just sort of becomes a black box for all of us, doesn't it? Because nobody can really tell the NSA how to do its job, because doing its job is a matter of secrecy from the outset. So how are you going to deal with that in the case?
Well, I mean, what it's true. We can't. A judge is going to defer to the NSA quite a bit on what it needs to do to conduct effective investigations. But what we can emphasize is that this program, where you collect there must be something besides collecting everything. Anything would be more narrowly tailored than just collecting all the data that's out there. The NSA has a lot of ability, but aside from this program, to collect information. They can get a search warrant. They can get what we call a D letter and obtain information. There's lots of ways they have to acquire information. But when they do that, it's more targeted. You actually are only acquiring information about who, because you believe that information is going to lead you to, in this case, a link to terrorism. So if they have a specific connection, a specific link, then that's not going to be within our case. And we're saying it's those specific links that they need. That's going to make this would be the constitutional alternative to the bulk collection, where we'll just collect everyone's telephone records and keep them for 5 years, because some point in the future we might want to look to see who you called and who the person you – all the people you called, and then who all the people they called as well. So.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that's been a big challenge in these constitutional challenges to NSA and other surveillance has been the standing issue. And,
yes.
And are you pretty confident that that's out of the picture now?
Well, we fully expect that the government will try and have our lawsuit dismissed on standing grounds, saying that that our clients can't show that they suffered any type of particular injury because of this program. And that's an issue we actually really look forward to litigating, because we think in the First Amendment context, our clients prepared and we're prepared to discuss and we're prepared to submit this evidence that they have suffered actual injury because of this program, that we have several clients who operate hotlines, for example, and that their hotlines are receiving fewer calls, they are not using the telephones for communications as they would in the past. And also, just on the most basic level, what we say in our complaint is that their inability to promise people who call them that the fact of their phone call will remain confidential, that in and of itself is a First Amendment injury. They're not being able to assure people who want to talk to them that they can keep the fact of that confidential. That in itself we think is an injury that should give our clients standing to pursue this lawsuit.
Eric, do you have any thoughts or observations about the suit? David's answered all of my questions.
And very well.
Yes.
Just two quick thoughts. I think that it's great to get the right of association issue out into the open. It's something that I think doesn't get the kind of love that perhaps it deserves. I don't want to say the doctrine gets overlooked, but I think it's a really important right that we have as citizens. And thinking about the ways that government activity could chill our ability to associate with people, I think is an integral part of the constitutional analysis. So I'm delighted that the EFF is raising the issue. The other piece I'll mention is where David mentioned about the alternatives to the kind of sweeping drift net type of data collections. I would point to the the takedown of the Dread Pirate Roberts. And I apologize, Denise. I didn't note if that's on our schedule elsewhere. Hope I'm not preempting it. But a lot of the work that they did there was somewhat traditional kind of work. They didn't need these kinds of mass data collection approaches in order to uncover someone who had taken some steps to try and create anonymity for himself. And I see that all the time in the cases I see, that a lot of the cases involving online prostitution or other types of crimes that involve a physical space component are broken by traditional law enforcement techniques, not these kinds of new age big data types of approaches. If I could say one more thing, Denise, and I hope again I'm not out of bounds. I am a longtime EFF financial supporter, and I hope that many of the listeners are as well. I just sleep better at night knowing that people like David are raising the challenges that they're raising.
Yep, as am I, and I feel the same way. The only thing we should probably do is for anyone who has not as up to the minute, up to speed on what your Dread Pirate Roberts reference was there. Not just as they write in E-Wake here, Sean Michael Kerner is the author of what I just pulled up. Not just the reference to the character from The Princess Bride, but also the alias for the alleged criminal mastermind allegedly behind the Silk Road website. Evan, have you been following that? Can you fill in the facts for us there at all?
I haven't really been following it all that much, other than just to see it's a pretty sensational story, and there's been a lot of drama around the site actually, the investigation of it as well. It's just one of those examples of the real dark underbelly of the internet, where crazy things happen even beyond our wildest imaginations there, allegedly. And so the thing I'm looking forward to the most about it is to learn more of the details about what actually was going on, and the legal story behind it is going to be a nice substrate for seeing factually what actually has unraveled with it as well. So it's just, there are some pretty seedy places on the line. This apparently was one of them, and I don't think we should be surprised that there's actually some action being taken on it in this way.
I see what you did there. Silk Road Unraveled. Very nicely done. Yes.
Oh, wow.
For anyone who is unfamiliar with what the Silk Road is or was, I mean, it apparently isn't going to be operational, given that its founder or mastermind, as he's characterized in this article, has been arrested. But it's been a way for people to anonymously traffic in illegal goods. So it's been something that has been in the sights of law enforcement for some time, and it will be interesting as it unfolds to see what issues are raised. David, do you see any First Amendment issues that could arise in the context of this case?
From what I know about it, I haven't seen a First Amendment issue yet. It seems mm-hmm. like what they are prosecuting him for primarily is selling or facilitating the sale of illegal drugs online, and then also I guess there's a contract killing allegation in the criminal charges. So I haven't seen anything that for me is going to raise First Amendment issues. A lot of the talk around the Silk Road prior to this, prior to his arrest the other day, seemed to be demonizing Bitcoin transactions and things like that. And again, that is as if the ability to purchase things with Bitcoin in itself was an evil. But it seems like the criminal prosecution is not going to focus on this. But again, I don't have any inside information about it. Just I did read the criminal charges, and that's as far as I got.
Yeah. We do everything else on the internet. Why not, our contract killings now working online as well. Evan?
Yeah. Devlin Hartline, he's a blogger. He writes with Terrence Hart over at Copy Hype. He put up a really funny tweet yesterday. I'm not looking at it now. I'm just going by memory. He says, if you can't trust the hitman that you found on Silk Road and paid with Bitcoin, who can you trust? Kind of sums it up.
It does indeed. Okay, well, that's the kind of consideration that is much on legislators' minds these days as they continue to try and enact laws that govern the internet. Let's look at a few issues on the law and policy front.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, we alluded to the fact that on episode 230 here, we would have lots to discuss about section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. We have, if not the world's most renowned scholar on the subject on the show with us today, it definitely top three, I would have to say. And so, Eric, you brought us up to speed the last time you were on the show on this challenge to section 230 and the fact that many state attorneys general want to amend Section 230 to include in, how do you word this properly, include in the exceptions to the immunity provided by Section 230, state crimes, state criminal acts. So that has been unfolding, but now there is a challenge to this proposed amendment coming from a conservative group that says this is going to break the internet and business in general. Do you think that that's going to sound a strong note with legislators who are worried about things like sex ads and sex trafficking and the other things that the state attorneys general have in mind here?
Right. So let's just go back. I know so many of the listeners and viewers are aware of the statute. The statute was passed in 1996, and it says, to summarize very efficiently, websites aren't liable for third-party content. And that basic foundation has led to the entire user-generated content industry. It's enabled the sites that we know and love to be able to allow users to talk to each other without having to intercede in that conversation and steer the conversation for fear of legal liability. If you look at the top websites by traffic, by volume, most of them are user-generated content sites. All of them rely heavily on Section 230. Section 230 has three statutory exceptions. One relates to the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Let's ignore that. Another relates to intellectual property, which is why copyright cases are covered under a different rule set. And the third is federal criminal prosecution. So if the Department of Justice in D.C. decides that it thinks there's a website that has allowed users to break the law, Section 230 doesn't hinder the Department of Justice from pursuing those cases. There might be other legal doctrines, including constitutional considerations, but the statute drops away. We go to those other concerns. The state attorneys general, 49 of them, asked Congress to change that amendment to allow state criminal prosecutions to also be excluded from this basic rule that websites aren't liable for third-party content. In other words, stated affirmatively, it would be fair game for states to enact crimes or to enforce crimes that would hold websites accountable for third-party content. The letter was sent in July, and it's been fairly quiet since then. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that our government has much bigger problems to deal with. We have problems like the fact our government isn't currently functioning. So the fact that it's not functioning kind of takes our attention away from what is, in that scale of things, a lot smaller problem. But when our government actually decides to function again, it's possible that we'll revisit what is the proper scope of protection for websites that allow users to talk to each other. In my mind, there are four different categories of content that are stressing Section 230. The state attorneys general are really feeling the handcuffs of this federal law. There's the online ads for illegal drugs, and the Silk Road was an example of a place where that was taking place. And Section 230 would have said nobody but the advertiser of those illegal drugs would have been liable under state criminal law for the advertisements. I think that's a good thing. Other people might disagree. But we also saw a lawsuit against Topix on the same issue, saying that Topix allowed users to publish ads for drugs and that Topix should be accountable for those. So once we get out of the Silk Road context, we might start to question just how far we'd go. The second category is online prostitution ads. That's been the main bugaboo for the state attorneys general for over a half decade. The third is revenge porn, and we're seeing a lot of interest in how to regulate revenge porn. And the final one I'll point out are the mugshot sites. These are sites that grab mugshots, publish them on the internet, search engine optimize the person who's depicted, and then charge the person depicted to remove the photo and the indexing so that they won't show up in vanity search results for that particular individual. And all of those areas are examples of problematic content where we are still working out our social norms about what we want, what kind of behavior we want online. And then we have to figure out who's accountable for that. And that conversation has, I think, proven more vexing than I might want. And that's why I think the topic is so current even today.
Eric, why is it that several states have tried to enact their own laws that are more targeted than what the state attorneys general are trying to do here? Since what they're concerned about are the buckets that you just mentioned, particularly the prostitution, some states have tried to enact laws that would make those kinds of ads illegal, but those laws have not been successful in going through. New Jersey most recently was blocked last month. Tennessee and Washington have tried the same thing. Why aren't these more narrowly tailored laws getting through state legislatures?
Well, actually, we are seeing state legislators pass laws that violate Section 230. And I can't recall if we're going to also talk about California's new law restricting advertising to minors.
Definitely.
That law just facially violates Section 230, and I'll reserve my further comments on it till when we talk about that. So the state legislators, they just don't care what Section 230 says. That's not their problem. Their goal is to manufacture laws and let the judges figure out which of those laws actually are good law. So we are seeing these laws pass. It is fair game for states to ban prostitution. It is fair game for states to ban advertising for prostitution. And it's fair game for states to ban online advertising of prostitution. What states can't do is then hold websites accountable for the illegal acts of others. So if there's an illegal online ad for prostitution, the person who publishes that ad takes full responsibility for it, but nobody else does. And all of the laws that we're seeing in the areas I described, coming from the states, are trying to reach out and grab the intermediaries, the websites that are allowing users to have their say, and that they simply can't do under Section 230. I will add, and I don't recall if we're going to get to the revenge porn topic, but California's new revenge porn law actually doesn't try to reach out and grab the websites. It was actually a model of restraint in that respect, in part because I think somewhere along the line, someone got the message, if we go for the gusto, the entire law might be invalid.
Eric, is there at least one or two little steps here that we may be kind of glossing over in thinking that if somehow the immunity under Section 230 were constrained in a way that made it okay for states to go after the website operator for violation of state law under the criminal statutes, does that automatically mean that in every instance where there's something unlawful going on that website, that operator is going to be held criminally liable? What I'm really getting at is, doesn't that still... that doesn't do anything to the fact, does it, that a prosecutor would have to prove the elements of the criminal claim undertaken by the website operator, which would include, in most instances, a mens rea, you know, this intention of knowingly having committed this crime. Just because they happen to have the website, the content on the website, or the website happens to have that content, whether known or unknown from the site operator, wouldn't necessarily be enough to see that these website operators are actually convicted. And what's the validity of that notion? And if so, does that make it so that the sky isn't falling quite as badly as a 230 purist might think it would?
Right. So I must be the 230 purist, and I own it. No questions about it. I'm an absolutist on this topic. But I hear what you're saying, Evan. It would be ideal that we could dial up degrees of severity in between a 0 and 1 and create the possibility of saying that if you're 0.9 along the way of having engaged in criminal conduct, you didn't do it, but you're 0.9 responsible, you should be accountable for that. And law professors love to say, but what about 0.8? What about 0.7? What about 0.6? We don't really know how to tune the dials very effectively in these contexts. But I don't agree with your basic premise. The idea that we should put these laws on the books, we should put some kind of adequate scienter requirements, and then you know, we'll defer to prosecutors to pick the right cases and go for it. The moment that we put a criminal liability in the, as a risk for website operation, we create the much more serious concern that entrepreneurs will simply choose not to go down that path. And given the kind of crusading that we see at the state and local level, where it's a great sport for elected political officials with enforcement power to say, "I'm cracking skulls on the internet." It's simply not logical for entrepreneurs to not only bet their money, to bet their time, but to bet their future liberty on the possibility that their entrepreneurial activities are legal. When the crimes get on the books, the effect on entrepreneurship is so devastating that all the things that you're talking about, all the procedural safeguards we might build in, are not going to be adequate to kind of to spur the kind of entrepreneurial behavior we've seen to date. And we see the difference in a place like Europe compared to here, where Europe has far less innovation with respect to user-generated content websites. In part, that's because they've had a history of bringing local or state-level prosecutorial efforts against websites, holding them accountable for user-generated content. What idiot wants to be an entrepreneur in Europe betting their personal liberty, whether they'll go to jail or not, based on the overzealous flag-waving, skull-cracking of a local prosecutor?
But what about someone like Hunter Moore? I mean, in the society that we live in, don't we want the law to do something devastating to his entrepreneurial decision to set up a website that invites people to send nude pictures of their victim ex-girlfriend and, you know, for the world to see? I mean, what about don't we want idiots like him to make decisions that are going to affect his liberty?
I'm not so casual about discussing who should be retain their liberty to be free from jail, as you might be. We're talking about life-changing events simply by being prosecuted, because at that point, when someone's prosecuted, their life has changed. They are fighting for their lives. I think we should be careful about using criminal sanctions. It's not just another tool in the toolkit. It's a really powerful one, perhaps one of the most powerful ones that the state can put into its toolkit in the first place. My point has been all along that before we think that we need criminal laws to go take out entrepreneurs who engage in dicey or perhaps objectionable content online, we should look and see whether or not those people are actually going to succeed. And the number of success stories for sites that have gone and trod on the dicier edges of internet content is really low. Most of these sites turn over really quickly. The combination of the marketplace plus the fact that there are so many other existing laws on the books that might regulate behavior that are outside the scope of 230, plus the fact that there's all kinds of technological ways of addressing problematic content, means that most of these sites, they turn over really quickly. They come on board, everyone gets all fired up, and then the sites are gone by the time that the lawmakers can even figure out that the site was around. And that's true with Hunter Moore sites as well. Those, they do not have longevity. So we might be troubled by the time period they're around, but we shouldn't ignore the fact that these sites do not stick around. And we don't. It's not simply because we're creating new laws or allowing state prosecutors to go crazy.
I promised you, Eric, that every time we came up against one of the stories where I learned some new naughty euphemism that I'd let you know. And this was one of them, this AP story that you pointed us toward about the latest challenge to the Attorney General's letter. And this is from commentary by Elizabeth McDougall, who is general counsel for Backpage.com, which is one of the companies that comes under fire for, illicit kinds of advertising. You were talking about technological ways of addressing this, and that is what her argument is, saying that the legal change is unnecessary because their filtering software already catches and is tuned to try and catch terms that are code for child prostitution, like schoolgirl. And here's the one that really kind of blew me away: trip to the islands.
I hadn't heard that either.
Yeah. So
Denise, don't you
live my promise.
Denise, don't you live on an island?
I don't. No.
I thought you were on Balboa Island.
We're very close to Balboa Island, but I don't live on it. Yes.
Make sure you don't take trips there.
Yes. Exactly. No. If I do, I'm going to be careful how I phrase it or where I phrase it. All right. Well, let's look at a couple of 230 related cases that perhaps help illustrate the points that Eric is making about how important this law is to everything that we have come to expect from the modern internet. One of them is the Chubby Checker case that you wrote up, Eric, on your blog. Another great, naughty innuendo opportunity here, because the case involved an app that was not about a much-loved classic rocker Chubby Checker, but in fact was designed for those male, and I was about to say male members of society.
But Bob.
Yes, who are interested in weights and measures, shall we say. And the term Chubby Checker was used literally in the name of the act. Now, the musical artist Chubby Checker and the rights holders associated with him objected to this and attempted to hold the App Store. Was it the Apple App Store that was at issue here, Eric?
It was the Hewlett-Packard App Store.
Hewlett-Packard, that's right. Responsible for having this app in the store. And as you point out in your write-up, this seems to be the first instance where Section 230 has come into play to protect an app store from the things that may appear in it and immunize the marketplace, as it were, which I find really interesting because some app stores, such as Apple, are pretty notorious for their involvement in the content that actually appears in the App Store. And that can be a big consideration under Section 230, can't it, Eric?
It might be. And we haven't seen a lot of action in the context of a traditional e-commerce retailer taking advantage of Section 230, even if they're selling third-party stuff. We have seen, however, Section 230 applied in marketplaces such as eBay and Amazon Marketplace. And I don't want to say it's been completely uniform. I'd have to go back and double check that. But invariably, eBay and Amazon have gotten protection under Section 230 for what their merchants are doing. Even though eBay and Amazon might provide a lot of support for these merchants, not just providing the hosting space for their advertising, but they would be providing things like the payment services as well. All of that has been effectively immaterial in Section 230 jurisprudence. But the plaintiffs look for those kinds of contacts, the ways in which the intermediary provides support for or help to the alleged tortfeasor to argue that really the intermediary should be held accountable alongside the merchant. And so in the Chubby Checker case, it's tempting for the plaintiffs to point out all the ways in which the App Store operator reviews apps and has a payment mechanism for apps, just like eBay and Amazon do. And it was nice to see a judge say none of that really is relevant. We've learned that over the last 15 plus years that providing a marketplace style environment is still protected under Section 230. Interestingly, the court did not reject the trademark claim against Hewlett Packard, saying I need to think about that trademark claim more carefully. And so all the things that Hewlett Packard did provide support for the app vendor, things like the payment services and the review of the app and the ability to kick the apps out of the store and all those kinds of things are completely relevant to the trademark claims. And it shows how powerful Section 230 is that we don't even ask those questions in Section 230 land, but if the plaintiffs can find some other argument, all the things you mentioned, Denise, become instantly relevant.
Well, I don't know how we don't make Chubby Checker our first passphrase for MCLE purposes for this episode of This Week in Law. So it's going to be that, Chubby Checker. If you are listening to the show in hope of getting continuing legal education credit in your jurisdiction, head on over to our, aside from the fact that, of course, it's a largely entertaining show. You may as well get a little MCLE out of it if you can. And we have a resource for you if you are in hope of doing that. That's at wiki.twit.tv. Go to our show, This Week in Law. And there's a page there that will walk you through the requirements in the various U.S. jurisdictions in any rate. And some people listen to the show for credit in other industries as well, besides the legal one. So we're glad that you do that. And we put these phrases in the show in case your particular governing body needs proof that you've actually listened and you're not just plucking this out of the air going, yeah, I listened to that great show with David Green and Eric Goldman and Denise and Evan. Evan, do you think that that this is a good outcome? That let's envision an app store that really takes an active role in vetting what goes there and what doesn't go there. And somehow something sneaks in that is that is problematic. Do you think that this kind of immunity is going to be fairly bulletproof or more of a Swiss cheese?
Well, it really seems like the perfect scenario for applying Section 230 immunity, because the great thing about it is that it does make investment and, you know, effort toward infrastructure worthwhile, so that the entrepreneur, those, you know, actually seeking to build the platform, feel safe for it. And where else is there more commerce going on the internet than in an app store? So, you know, I think it's perfectly sensible that an app store should be protected in this way. You know, we've still got these more nuanced questions about the trademark violation. You know, in this particular situation, I wonder where that's going to go, because it seems like Chubby Checkers just being used in a merely descriptive sense in this regard. So, you know, what's really going on here? So I'm glad that Chubby Checker was able to rise to the occasion, because anyway,
that's even worse than mine.
He was really getting stiffed. I mean, I'm glad that stand up for himself.
David, save us. Do you have any thoughts on this case or on the Attorney's General proposal to amend Section 230? Oh, David, did you mute yourself by any chance?
Did I? Can you hear me now?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. I must have hit that with my elbow. Yeah, we actually worked on some of these cases and were involved in the New Jersey case. And the Washington case, both, and our client there was the Internet Archive, saying that, you know, it's not, you know, these laws are covering not just entities like Backpage that are running the advertisements, but also entities that are archiving and, you know, essentially creating libraries of the internet as well, and make sure that those interests were before the court. And one of the important things to note is that these courts aren't just striking these laws down as violating Section 230; they're also striking them down as violating the First Amendment. So that even if Even if Section 230 didn't exist, the way these laws are written, they would still be unconstitutional. And for a lot of these reasons that we've already talked about, when you're leaving whether or not to charge someone who's speaking with a crime to the discretion of prosecutors, well, that's a big concern in First Amendment law because it creates a chilling effect. And people aren't going to want to risk, you know, leaving their liberty up to the discretion of a prosecutor when they're trying to decide whether or not to speak, whether or not to collect information and make that available to people. And that's a serious First Amendment problem. Another problem in that area is that these laws are tremendously vague, and legislators tend to want to try and grab as much stuff as they can and tend to try and write these laws that are very expansive and that go far beyond the very limited categories of information they're actually concerned about. I understand the attorneys general being frustrated with Section 230, but really there's very little that they're going to be able to do to try and actually give the legislators the powers that they're trying to seize.
Well, I think you've teed us up very well to discuss the two laws recently enacted in California, but not yet in effect in California, that Eric has so ably written up over at Forbes. And described not just what they will do, but if they go into effect, but how they are problematic under federal constitutional law. So why don't we start with the first one, Eric? Let's start with the eraser law. This law enables minors, and now it's important to realize for purposes of analyzing this law that includes not just people under the age of 13, which is the cutoff for the federal Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, but also under the age of 18 here. So we have this whole category of people being regulated that websites aren't used to dealing with because they mostly just make it easy for themselves and say, if you're under 13, you can't use the site. So now we may find ourselves seeing, well, maybe that's going to be bumped up because people aren't going to want to have to comply with this California law. But what it will do when it goes into effect is allow people to pull the plug on their past posts to decide, well, gee, when I was young and foolish and under the age of 18, And again, you know, as I tee this up, I may not be saying it right. You may have to make this decision while you're young and foolish and under the age of 18 in order for it to actually work under the law. But what you're able to do is pull something down that you posted in what you now feel is an ill-advised way. You've shot it through multiple holes in your Forbes post, Eric. Why don't you run through some of them for us?
So the idea is pretty simple, that kids are going to be kids online. And it's unreasonable for us as a society to expect kids to have the kind of wisdom and maturity that we expect from adults. But we give kids a very powerful tool, the power to publish content before they've developed the wisdom of figuring out how to do that appropriately. So the rationale is give kids the chance to change their mind, to realize that they made a foolish mistake, as kids do. It's not a criticism of them. It's just an acknowledgement of the reality. And let them wipe the slate clean, walk away from content that they previously posted once they realize that that's not what they want to say. There's so many problems with that basic architecture. There's so many ways in which that could never be true from a technological standpoint, and that could never really be true from a legal standpoint, that any law trying to effectuate that goal is doomed to fail. This law, unfortunately, wasn't even well drafted. And so you've got a law that never really could succeed at accomplishing that big, broad objective, and then a poorly expressed law at that, so it's really doubly ineffectual. The law only targets the post that the minor made him or herself. So here's how it goes. I make a post to Facebook, and then I can go back to Facebook and I can delete that post. Now, if anyone has copied and pasted that anywhere else on Facebook, the law doesn't apply to that, and the kid can't wipe that slate clean. The law also doesn't require any third parties that might have indexed the content or otherwise copied the content. So if Google has picked up that content, the law doesn't require Google to delete that post either. Now, as a practical matter, a site like Google will refresh its index over time. So if it deletes from site A, where it's indexed, it'll also come out of Google's site index B. But the point is that it only targets the one instance of that content that the user, him or herself, uploaded. And that's, at best, a very incomplete solution. But let's assume for a moment that that solution is the right place, that that's where all the links are pointing, and that's where all the heat is taking place, that's where everyone knows to look to find this problematic content. To the extent that the website has allowed other users to comment on that post, for example, to talk about it, giving minors the right to wipe away that actually then leaves that entire conversation orphaned. We're not quite sure what to do about it. It leaves all the links and the discussion at those links that point to the content also orphaned. And so you basically are ripping a hole out of the fabric of history and saying there was this really important conversation that might have been taking place. You can't see the source material. You can only see the echoes that it left. So it creates a bunch of problems in terms of the integrity of conversations, that we might very well undermine the integrity of these conversations. There's a bunch of other drafting errors and ambiguities in it, but I'll just highlight the one that Denise referenced. The law doesn't make clear when the minor can exercise this right. If the minor can exercise it only while they're a minor, or if the minor can exercise it for the rest of their lives. So they could be 100 years old and go back and say, you know, I want to get rid of a post I made 85 years ago. I don't think that's the correct interpretation. I think the correct interpretation from my reading of the statute is that only minors can do it. And so the idea is that kids don't have the power to know what they want to stand behind for the rest of their lives. They don't have the judgment or wisdom. And yet the law puts that decision in their hands, saying, if you want to take advantage of this legal right, you have to do it while you still don't have that judgment. So from that perspective, I'm just also quizzical that if the goal was to give kids the power to wipe away their youthful indiscretions, they have to decide while they're still a youth. And that also seems like it doesn't actually solve the stated problem it was trying to solve.
This is not as important as the implications of the law, but I thought it was interesting that these laws, the two that we're going to discuss here, this eraser law and also the advertising directed to minors law, that they're not going into effect. They've been enacted, but they're not going into effect until 2015. Do you know why that is, Eric?
I don't know specifically, but this particular law will require a bunch of custom coding on the part of some user-generated content websites. They'll have to build a system that will allow users to exercise the controls that are specified in the law. Plus, there's also a bunch of disclosure obligations. The website has to explain to the minor users about their rights. And so my assumption is that the time period or the time delay was built so that the websites would have time to actually do the work that they may be required to do under the law.
Gotcha. And then you updated your post to include, I thought the commerce clause portion of your discussion was very interesting and something that it's not something I often say. The commerce clause part was really fascinating, but it is because the crux of that is the dormant commerce clause. Now I'm back in law school, con law. If I'm remembering correctly, the reason why it's a dormant commerce clause consideration is because on the face of the law doesn't talk about regulating interstate commerce, which is a no-no for the states. That's reserved to the federal government. But in operation, that's what happens because in order for websites to deal with people in California, they are going to have to comply with that law. Do I have that essentially right, Eric?
I think you had a couple double negatives there. Could you try that one again?
that's negative.
I kind of lost it there. Once I heard the word dormant commerce clause, and I realized you're going back to the law school, and I thought, whoa, I can't believe Denise is going to go there.
No. But it's something that lawmakers really need to be aware of today, because it's hard to enact a law that relates to the internet that's not going to govern interstate commerce. And that's what California's gone and done here.
Correct. And I go one step further. I have, again, an absolutist perspective, but it's also informed by our discussion that we had about Section 230. States have no business trying to regulate the internet, because there's no easy and reliable way for websites outside of California to block off or wall off California, to opt out of legal compliance by saying, fine, if that's the law, I just won't deal with California. There's no technological way to reinstantiate that physical border into the borderless network of the internet. And without that ability to create those physical walls between states, then any state's effort to regulate internet activity by definition reaches out and potentially applies to people outside of the jurisdiction. And I just take the position that states have no business doing so because of the Dormant Commerce Clause. It's a very absolutist position, but it's the only one I think fits the current technological state.
Right. And then the other fascinating point that you raised, Eric, that I'm sure David is equally fascinated with, is the First Amendment issue with the law, which means that if a website, you give some nice examples at the end of your article, that if a website or a news organization does a compilation of information and a lot of reporting on an important issue, such as you use cyberbullying as an example, and one of the users or miners highlighted in the coverage decides, no, you're not going to be able to use my thoughts on that now. I've decided under this eraser law that I'd like that excised from what I submitted, that has a direct First Amendment impact on the publisher who's compiled all this information and is trying to get it out there to the world. David, what do you think is going to happen with this law?
What do I think is going to happen? I'm hopeful it never actually goes into effect, and you know, for all the reasons Eric said, and also as you were sort of getting to, there's a lot of applications of this law that I think would be clearly unconstitutional. Whether there are enough of them to strike down the law as a whole, I haven't really assessed yet. But you know, as a general First Amendment matter, somebody has a almost absolute right to publish information that they obtained legally. That's a matter of public interest. Mm-hmm. And so this law certainly could not constitutionally be used by someone who wants to take information that they provided to a third party and then remove that, even though the information comes as a matter of public interest. So you know, a political candidate's children or even someone who's trying to erase their past. I mean, a lot of the goals of this law is to really allow people to you know hide the mistakes they made as kids. But sometimes the mistakes people made as kids, you know, when they're 17 and three quarters, you know, are actually newsworthy and important information to have, and someone should not have the ability to insist that all that information be removed. There's a public interest in people not being able to sanitize their histories as well. So again, this might be very well intentioned, but it is fraught with constitutional problems.
Hey, David.
Go ahead, Eric.
Hey, David. Just a question for you. I'm with you, brother. But my question is, I have not heard of any concerted efforts to actually bring a constitutional challenge to law. And I'm curious if you have. And I had asked internally at the EFF if the EFF had an official position on this law. And I don't think I got a good answer. So do you know if the EFF is planning to challenge the law, or have you heard of others who might be challenging the law? Or might it go into effect because no one's going to step forward and actually try to bring that challenge?
Yeah, you know, I don't. You know, we haven't made any decision about what to do with it here internally at EFF, so I can't speak for the organization on this point. And I don't know, and I haven't just been following whether there's going to be any constitutional challenge to it. I think you know the one of the difficulties here would be we can think of lots of situations where this law could not be constitutionally applied to a situation. Whether that makes the law facially unconstitutional is a much different question. And before you bring any lawsuit, you have to really assess whether or not the law is subject to so few constitutional applications that it would be facially overbroad. I haven't made that assessment yet. I just don't know whether there are people out there working on that.
Thank you. I know there are constitutional law professors all over the country who are grateful to the state of California for enacting this and its companion law that we're going to discuss in a minute, because their test giving this year got a lot easier as the result. What else did I want to ask about this crazy law? Evan, do you think it's that crazy? I mean, is there a way for a right to be forgotten law to be enacted that could look better than this one does?
I'm glad you couched it in that terms. I don't think we'd actually used the term right to be forgotten yet in our conversation. And I've just always wondered, you know, is this coming from the same part of the brain that, you know, the French and other Europeans are using, talking about this right to be forgotten? And I suppose that it is. And that seems to be a cultural norm. And I just wonder how that norm could ever be stopped. You know, if it's going to be unsuccessful here in this iteration in California, you know, it's a real sentiment of the human spirit to have this right of the individual to sanitize his or her history. And that's the real provocative point that I was about ready to comment on, David, and what you just said. You know, in your comments, you really built up to this provocative statement that there's, and I don't want to mischaracterize you, I'm not intentionally trying to do it, but you said something like there's that the constitutional right would essentially triumph over any right of the individual to sanitize his or her history. And at least how I heard it, that essentially annihilates the individual interest, the individual right in a personal dignity of having, you know, a certain impression made about them at their own hand, published to the web. And that just seems really provocative to me. And I, you know, I'm more of the side. I'm certainly not an absolutist when it comes to this, because I certainly see it a really important countervailing interest in the right of the individual to determine how, you know, what sort of esteem he or she is held, you know, on the web. That seems like there's an interest there that's just as important as any kind of constitutional interest in, you know, everybody else being in on everybody else's business. So that's where I get a little bit befuddled in thinking about this.
Yeah, well, I certainly enjoy being provocative, so I'm happy to play that role. But I was actually saying something just a little bit different than that. I was talking about when the constitutional right that really attaches when the information that someone seeks to remove is a matter of public interest. I recognize there are situations when people have information that's private information they want to remain private information that might have been posted imprudently as a youthful indiscretion, and I acknowledge that's a different situation. I don't know how possible it is to write a law that really is limited to that type of information. I'm just saying that what this law that was passed allows for is someone to take vitally important public information and have a matter of right have it removed from certain media.
I get it.
Hey, Evan.
Yes, sir.
I would also add that to the extent that we do value the concerns that you raised, the marketplace has already heard that, and so many user generated content sites do give users the ability to edit or delete their content. They don't do it because of the law. They do it because they believe that's what their users want or demand. I have no problem with that. There's a big difference between the marketplace choosing that solution and the government mandating it. And that's, I think, the place where I get really troubled, because we should let the marketplace decide that solution, given how much work has already been done in the marketplace to provide solutions to users. It seems like the law deals with a pretty narrow set of circumstances. And in those circumstances, actually, we might say those are exactly the places where we want website operators to have the power to make a different choice.
Right. We all know that the real harmful content doesn't exist on Facebook or, you know, the other sites, platforms that will readily take the content down. It's on more of the rogue sites, and where the content won't be removed unless there is something compulsory under the law that requires them to do that, assuming they're in the United States, of course. Most of the,
I'm sorry, they drive it off seas. I'm still a little bit unclear about that. So remember, the law doesn't apply if anyone else has cut and paste that content elsewhere. So we're talking about a minor who has gone to this rogue site, who has posted it, and then wants to change his or her mind at that rogue site. That's a pretty narrow set of circumstances. Even before we ask the question whether the rogue site has given power to the users to delete their own content.
Well, whether it's a narrow set of circumstances, that wouldn't mitigate the harmful effects and the remedy that the law is trying to address. Yeah, I acknowledge that would be rare, but kids do a bunch of stupid things that they learn to regret. And if that weren't the reality, then there wouldn't be any need to have this legislation in the first place.
Well, there may not have been any need for legislation in the first place. It might be that this was some state legislator thought that it was really important to just lock down the current business practices among the leading internet companies and make everyone else comply with that standard. Not necessarily because we can point to specific examples where this law would have fixed the problem. And in fact, I would invite you or anyone else to point to a specific example where this law would have fixed a problem, where the miner made a post, wants to delete that post. The website did not let them delete that post, and that was a good outcome under things like the First Amendment. In other words, that was something where the state could have compelled the deletion of that content. If you've got an example like that, I'd love to hear it. I can't think in all the things I've seen in my studies of internet law over the last 20 years where that situation has actually come out.
Yeah, that seems like it would be a really tough position for a website to take when a minor's knocking on their door and saying, take this down. Hey, we got a question from...
Denise, I'm sorry. It's not just the knocking on the door. It's the fact that so many of the websites are giving the automated tools in the first place.
Right.
So, it's not even that the miners have to go beg the site. The real harm that I think Evan's driving at is when some third party uploads content about an individual. And this law doesn't attempt to address that whatsoever. So if that's the real action, this law doesn't even purport to address it. And we would have to have a really hard discussion about if it's even addressable at all, both under social policy considerations as well as under the Constitution.
You see, that's the norm, or that's the idea I'm trying to get at, and it's because this norm that I'm expressing of the sanctity of the individual and his or her dignity is what's the organizing principle in my thoughts. And so I wouldn't dare overtly say, yeah, this law doesn't go far enough, because you guys have already given me a hard enough time with it the way it is.
Come on, Evan, say it. Please.
I don't agree with your basic premises a long way from that's a bunch of crap, though. So we've moved ahead in our discourse from at least last week's show.
Right. We're so erudite now.
Yes, exactly. Hey, we got a good question in IRC from N. Zimmerman there that makes me think about any evidentiary ramifications of this law. And the question is, when this law goes into effect, will it only affect what's published online, or would it also affect backups and potential records that the website may have been keeping? And getting back to the publication of things in the public interest point that David raised, I'm going to drop in our first Breaking Bad reference for the show and say this raises the Brock's brother problem. Okay, so without any spoilers for the show, if people know who Brock's brother is in the show, a child who engages in illegal activity, although he is a minor, and law enforcement would certainly want to gather evidence about that activity, would law enforcement have a harder time doing that in the presence of this law? Or would it be shut out completely? Eric, would it go to records and backups?
The law is very explicit about this. The law says that the website is obligated to allow the minor to delete the post publicly, but the website is not obligated to go and flush it from any archives that it has that are not publicly published. And it actually gives some very specific examples of what's okay or not. So as a practical matter, my guess is that websites will continue to retain their server logs and their other backup data files as they've done in the past, and this law wouldn't require them to change their practices. So I think there's other questions, including questions that the EFF constantly asks about how long websites should be retaining that data, but this law doesn't change that discussion at all.
All right. Well, let's get into law number two that was enacted at the same time. The Advertising Directed at Minors Act suffers from the same interesting dormant commerce clause problem in that it's without overtly saying so, purporting to regulate activities going on among people in other states. And some of the other problems that we've just discussed with regard to the eraser problem. But here, the policy issue that the lawmakers are trying to get at is sort of the Joe Camel issue. You don't want advertising for things that it's illegal for minors to buy being targeted at minors, I guess, in an online situation. One of my questions about this, Eric, is why did we need to, well, I think I know the answer to this or what your answer is going to be. Why did we need to enact this law? There are other laws that prevent you from advertising to minors if it's something that they are not allowed to buy, aren't there?
Not necessarily. I'd have to go through and look at each and every item and look at how the existing law would regulate the advertising of it. The law covers dozens, hundreds, thousands of different types of items in the marketplace. So I don't think I have a single answer for you, Denise. I'm not sure that it would be as clean as you just described.
Okay, good. Well, then at least the lawmakers weren't just completely repetitive of other things that are out there. Why, in what ways is this law problematic that differ at all from what we just discussed?
So let me just describe the law in a little bit more detail. The law enumerates a bunch of items that are illegal for minors to buy. My guess is that some legislative staffer went through the California law books and found every item that said this is illegal to sell to minors. And then enumerated all these items and said, with respect to these items, websites are obligated to prevent minors from seeing ads for these items. And that's in one of two ways. If the website itself is running its own ads, so like a astroturfing site or a branded site where they're promoting their own products, this law would say you can't be appealing to teens and below. And if you know you're dealing with teens or below, then you've got to block them somehow. We don't see too many sites like that where there's a cigarette site that's designed to appeal to teens or to minors under the age of teenagers. So I'm not quite sure how often that would come up. Now, with all other sites, if the site is appealing to minors, teens or under, or knows that it has teens or under, it has to block the ads for these restricted items from showing to these minors. And there's a dormant commerce clause problem. There's a First Amendment problem in the sense that First Amendment does protect advertising. And it also says, and I'm going to summarize somewhat glibly, that we can't just prevent the ads that would be appropriate for adults to be blocked because there might be children in the same audience. So there's some First Amendment problems, and David might have some more cogent thoughts about those. But the real problem is that the law tries to hold the websites accountable for third-party ads. And this is exactly what we discussed earlier with respect to the online prostitution ads and the ads for illegal drugs that might show up on a place like Topics or Craigslist. The Section 230 says you can't hold websites liable for third-party ads. And that's not even a close question. This goes straight into the gut of Section 230 and basically gives the big birdie to Congress and says, I don't care what you said. We want to do something different here. So this law, the entire architecture of the law, saying that websites are accountable for what their third-party advertisements are showing on their website, is simply not possible for Congress for California to do. Congress said otherwise.
Got it. What do you think, David, about the First Amendment implications of this law?
Well, I agree with I agree with everything that Eric just said. You know, there's where the sort of basic principles, and we've had this in a bunch of different media, and it's sort of especially poignant with internet, is that you can't try and sanitize a media that both adults and children use because you're concerned that children are going to see things. So whether that is, you know, what people see from the highway when they're driving their cars from a drive-in movie theater, to what they're seeing, you know, to what they get on the internet when this, you know, this in some ways law is reminiscent back to the original provisions of the Communications Decency Act that were struck down in ACLU versus Reno, you know, where the court said that we're not going to require that the inbox you know, have the level of dialogue as the sandbox. Is that when adults and minors are both enjoying a media and using a medium, that you can't make it safe for children just because children are there. And that's a very, again, we've seen that in a lot of different situations in the First Amendment throughout time. It's not unique to the internet. But I think this law runs into that problem.
Yeah, children, they complicate everything. I can tell you that from first-hand experience. Evan, what do you think about this advertising law?
Yeah, children do complicate everything. And it's interesting, my sensibilities have changed about this since having children. But at the end of the day, despite my you know, moving to the right a little bit on these First Amendment issues since having children, I recognize and understand the risk of overbreadth, and you know, there's nothing that's going to stop at the end of the day the sensibility and the good sense behind First Amendment jurisprudence that is concerned about these issues that David was talking about, not having the medium be eviscerated just because of the potential for you know, children to happen upon the content, and this seems to suffer from those defects. And there's a little more that I can add to the great commentary on it so far.
Well, Eric, I know that you need to run and have already given us more of your time today than you actually had. So we're thrilled that you've been able to do that. I had one other story in the rundown that was from your blog, the Dirtiest Hotels case, the TripAdvisor case. And I'll just toss that out. Do you think there's anything? This was a case that found that that TripAdvisor was protected under various rationales, including Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, when it put together its own list based on comments made by its users of hotels that, you know, it would recommend people not frequent because of the filth level there. And there are some interesting First Amendment glosses to this case too, because of the defamation angle here. Is there, you know, are we making factual statements about these hotels or opinion, and the fact that it's all being gleaned from user comments? The site TripAdvisor wound up being immunized, but you weren't real wild about how the court got there, were you?
It's such an interesting question from a defamation law standpoint. TripAdvisor puts out a press release designed to promote its own business. This was not about providing tools for users to publish their own content. But TripAdvisor aggregated those comments from users into a press release. So it wanted to call attention to the fact that it's got a really great resource of user comments. And it used an appellation, dirtiest, unquestionably, the hotels listed on this list were not going to be happy. And I can't imagine TripAdvisor wasn't fully aware of that. They knew going in that calling a hotel dirtiest was going to make that hotel pretty upset. And they picked the word dirtiest. They didn't, TripAdvisor picked the word dirtiest. They didn't glean that out of the user comments. Instead, they used the user rankings about cleanliness to establish the rankings. But then TripAdvisor picked that word dirtiest. And the court said, you know, the word dirtiest is not a fact in the way that we can measure under defamation law. And so it's okay to call something the dirtiest, even if you can't prove that, because it's really more like an opinion. And then the hotel said, but look at all the quotes that it took from users to support that. Didn't those quotes define what TripAdvisor meant by dirtiest? And the court said, no, not really. And then finally, the press release contained those quotes. And then the plaintiff said, but we want to hold you accountable for those quotes. And that would be covered by Section 230, that the fact that TripAdvisor republished what its users said is exactly what Section 230 prevents. You can't hold websites accountable for what their users say. So it's a tricky question. There were some really interesting issues about the fact that TripAdvisor lays its own opinions or sentiments on top of what its users said. But the good news is that we get these kinds of rankings, these top 10 lists that are so popular. I think the terminology is listicle. Is that the right terminology? That are just a link bait. People love to link these top 10 lists. And we find them really useful. And so this opinion gives us a lot of breathing room for that. Not sure I would have gotten there the way the court did, but I'm glad it got where it did.
Listicle. That's a new one on me. Short form.
I'm sorry, of writing. It's not innuendo. No, I'm just joking.
Short form of writing, says Wikipedia, that uses a list as its thematic structure. So, yeah, another new term there. Yeah, no naughty innuendo there or in this story, other than, of course, if you're taking a trip to the islands, I suppose you would want to use this list of dirtiest hotels.
Well, dirtiest, Eric, could, of course, mean lots of different things, correct?
Yes. I was wondering at first blush whether, you know, the Cosmopolitan, based on their advertising scheme, would have been happy to land itself on this list in Las Vegas, that particular hotel. So we are going to go ahead and let you out of here, Eric, to go on and continue your wonderful studies and work and taking care of business over there at Santa Clara University. Of course, people should follow Eric on Twitter. He's Eric Goldman there. Any great big events coming up in your neck of the woods that you think people need to know about?
Well, I'll just mention, because it would be so relevant to this audience, we are going to have a Hot Topics in Internet Law session on campus October 17th. Anyone in the area, please contact me. Love to have you. We'll likely be recording it. I'm not sure if we're going to be streamcasting it. I'm double checking on that. But we will talk about the kind of stuff we talk about on this show. California legislature alone has been so busy that we could just spend our time talking and mocking the California legislature. And yet there's other good stuff to talk about. You know, we didn't put on the list, Denise, the whole Gmail ruling. I spent most of my week this week dealing with reporter calls about the Gmail ruling. So between the Gmail ruling and California legislature, lots of good stuff going on in Internet Law, October 17th in the morning.
All right, great. Thanks so much, Eric, for joining us. And
happy 230th anniversary. I love 230. In fact, I think I'm going to go get a tattoo of 230 to show how much I love it. So being here on this special occasion is
it's warmed our hearts too. Have a great afternoon and weekend, and we'll have you on again soon.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm checking off now. Bye-bye.
Okay.
See you later. I can't believe he doesn't already have one.
Maybe just a henna tattoo. You could renew from time to time. We need to drop another MCLE passphrase into the show, and I'm going to go harken back to our earlier discussion and use Internet Hitman as our second MCLE passphrase. For those of you who are interested in being able to demonstrate that you listened to the show, jot that one down as well as our earlier one. Let's see. We have lots more to discuss. I saved the shield law for the end of the show here after Eric signed off, because this is really more David's territory. So let's get to that. For folks who've been following the show, you know that from time to time we check in on the federal government's attempts to enact a federal shield law. There have been rumblings about this for a couple of years now. in Congress. And now we have a revised version that is better if you're someone like us, you know, someone who is sort of media of indiscriminate description, better if you're a blogger, better if you're someone, as Dan Gilmore likes to say, who is not necessarily someone who would be considered a traditional journalist, but someone who definitely commits acts of journalism from time to time. Because under the current way that the law is drafted, you would be able to invoke the Shield Law, at least with a court's, in a court's discretion, looking at your activities and saying, yeah, I know journalism when I see it, and it's that. So, David, are you pretty happy with the law on that front, or what else should we be paying attention to?
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about this version of the mm-hmm. Shield Law, and I've been actually getting quite a bit of heat for not criticizing it. Mm-hmm. But there's some things really to like about it. And again, it's certainly not perfect, but frankly, no Shield Law that exists out there is perfect. But this one has some nice features in it that we really haven't seen before, and it also seems to have gotten some broad support, at least in the Senate, which is nice. So whenever we talk about these Shield Laws, you know, one of the big problems is trying to decide who gets the protection of the law. You know, who is the person that can say, I don't have to testify or I don't have to produce information even though I've been given a valid subpoena? And some people like to phrase that question as being, well, who's a journalist? I tend to not like to phrase the question that way. And I'd like to think, well, who should be covered in this situation? And in 2009, there was a version of the law that passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee that actually did adopt a definition of covered person. That was the term that was being defined. And that was the definition that they started with this time when the law came back up. Very quickly, Senator Feinstein came in and said, no, I don't like that definition. I want to define journalist, and I'm going to define it mostly to be a person who is either currently salaried or employed by some type of media entity. It doesn't have to necessarily be a legacy traditional media entity, but it has to be some type of something that looks like a media entity. And or someone who in the past, even if they're not, if they're no longer employed by a media entity, someone who in the past has had at least some consistent history of having worked in that way. And I didn't like that for a lot of reasons. One, because I thought it was very limited. I thought it made a lot of ambiguity about whether someone who was a self-publisher or a freelance journalist, whether if someone did self-publish, even if they published regularly and it really was sort of real and looked a lot like journalism, whether that would be considered an entity. There was a lot of ambiguity in it. And I also didn't like the fact that it actually decided to define journalists. And again, I don't think it's necessary to define journalists to pass these laws. What we end up coming out of committee was a compromise where Senator Schumer went back to Senator Feinstein and said, well, let's see if we could work on this. And so the law that passed now defines covered journalist. So it's not purporting to define sort of what a journalist is for all purposes, or even saying that all journalists are entitled to protections of this law. Mm-hmm. And it still has some of these provisions that talk about you get the protection if you are employed by some type of entity that regularly publishes news. The revised version actually took the look back provisions and made them much more generous. So it goes back much farther, as far as 20 years now. And then even more recently, if you over the past 5 years have 3 consecutive months of news gathering or news reporting, then you qualify. So it ends up being very expensive that way. But the thing I did, I think, that's really great that I actually have not seen in a proposed federal Shield Law yet, it's that it creates this provision that says even if you don't meet any of those definitions, a judge always has discretion to find that the law should apply to somebody else if, in the interest of justice and in considering the interests of journalism, the interests of the public getting information, the law should be applied in that way. And I think that's, for me, that whenever we try and think of examples of who wouldn't this law cover, at least now those people have the potential, a potential avenue of getting coverage under the law. Now, It's not perfect because we are leaving up to a judge's discretion, and inevitably some judges are going to make decisions I like in this area and some judges are going to make decisions I don't like in this area.
Right. But, and the other big area, I agree that leaving it, making it much more open-ended as to who will qualify for the protection and giving some judicial discretion is a good thing. But the area that it has been under fire, it seems the most, is the fact that national security, the national security exemption from the law, that, you know, if you're someone who reports on national security issues, you're going to be out of luck under the this particular SHIELD law, version of the SHIELD law.
You know, that's something I would love to understand more. What that whole issue? I can't get my mind around how that exception is supposed to work and what the criticisms are. So could I be so bold as to ask Dave, could you explain that?
Help me understand it? Yeah, I'm sort of wishing I had the exact language right in front of me now. But what it is, because I'm afraid I'm going to be not completely accurate here.
I'm just a man of ideas. All I want is the concept.
Let me give you my best shot. Yeah, what it essentially says is that this protection is not available when the information that is sought pertains to the national security. And what they're really going after here, I think, is after people who leak national security information, and that you cannot maintain the confidentiality of that source's identity. It's a troublesome provision because it's a category. And I'm not saying that there's no situation where national security interests shouldn't trump these interests. I won't go that far. The reason the national security exemption to me is troublesome is because it is a categorical exemption. And the way it typically works in these SHIELD laws is that they're essentially a qualified test where there are situations where other interests may override the journalist's interest and the source's interest in having their identity and the information remain confidential. But you do that on a case-by-case basis. And we're much more comfortable with case-by-case determinations because they allow a judge to consider all the facts and nuances of a specific situation. And hopefully then you're actually minimizing the amount of times when the public's right and the journalist's rights are overcome. And so what we get here is instead of that contextual case-by-case situation, we get a categorical exclusion. And that's why I find that to be problematic. It's largely a political thing. What happened in 2009 was that this bill was presented, it passed the Senate, and the White House said, you know, we won't sign it without a national security exemption. And so now the idea is, well, it's not worth having a bill that doesn't have a national security exemption. But if you look at the way that the law has operated anyway, it's really hard in real national security situations to get this protection at all. So in some ways, it's the provision wasn't even necessary, and probably the government probably had the protection it wanted in national security anyway. But we have now in there a categorical exception, and it's not good. I mean, that's one of the things I'd like to change if I could change about the law.
Right. So one of the ways in which WikiLeaks would not benefit from this law is that categorical exception. But assuming we could leave that aside and there is other information in the hands of WikiLeaks or other entities like it that might not implicate national security considerations, would an entity like that, do you think, fall within the law or outside the law, or would, again, we have get into the judicial discretion aspect?
I'm really hesitant to say that, well, this organization or that organization would or not fall within the definition of the law, because frankly, it's the law doesn't work that way. It looks at the specific activity. For example, if I have a newspaper, it doesn't mean that I never have to answer a subpoena. I only don't have to answer a subpoena when it's seeking my news gathered information. You know, if they want a subpoena for my shopping list, they can get that. And so there's when you have entity, and again, that's it's a silly example, but when you have entities that do a lot of different things, that do journalism and do other stuff, you can't say, well, the entity is going to be protected. You can say, well, the entity when the subpoena seeks the journalistic material, then that's the situation where the law will the protection will apply. So it's a more it's a difficult thing to say, well, an entity that does both journalism and other stuff is going to be protected. Well, maybe sometimes, right? The bigger problem I think that WikiLeaks might have is that what Senator Feinstein wanted to do was to write a provision that would specifically exclude WikiLeaks from the law. And so there's this provisional law that says that covered journalists does not include, and again, I don't have the law right in front of me, so I'm going to paraphrase, does not include entities that have as their overriding purpose to merely funnel classified governmental information to the public. And only to do that without adding commentary or reporting or explaining it. And that seems to be an attempt to distinguish at least what what Senator Feinstein thinks WikiLeaks is from media entities that would then report on the material that WikiLeaks makes available. And so, yeah, it's a weird provision. It actually, the way the statute's written is that even if you did fall within that, you still could go to the judge and ask the judge to exercise discretion to find that you were covered. But that provision certainly seems aimed, at WikiLeaks and someone that would attempt its model where the sole purpose seems to be just to provide a funnel of confidential information from someone who would improperly acquire the information out to the public.
You could almost see it as a kind of a safety valve against the notion that covered journalism depends on what the activity is rather than the enterprise in which the person is engaged or for whom the person is employed or whatever. Because something like that, you could see a proponent, and I certainly don't know what was in Senator Feinstein's mind on this, but you could see a proponent of that saying, well, we don't want to ensure that somebody can fall under this idea of merely having published the information in order to get these protections. It allows more room for there to be a broader category of people who are covered journalists, bloggers, bona fide people who really are out there trying to distribute content in a meaningful way. But certainly there is the troubling aspect of it as well, to the extent that one is a supporter of WikiLeaks. And I can't remember if it was Trevor Tim. I mean, every time I think of WikiLeaks, I think of Trevor Tim and mm-hmm. All the wonderful exposition he's done of it and helping us understand the role it plays in the news ecosystem, to the extent that, he was saying, it's been responsible for so many of the widely read stories of the past few years. I think that was Trevor Tim.
And there certainly are times when WikiLeaks was doing journalism, and again, I don't like to have to define that world, but I think that word, but I think under any definition, I think, the reporting of the helicopter stuff, I think it's hard to find that not looking like journalism. Now, some of the other leaks might have looked more like just providing information to media the way they looked more like a source. But that particular instance, that was journalism under any definition of the word.
You need do little more other than just show the video. The point gets across just by having disclosed it. That's of its nature.
Right. All right. Well, let's move on to our tip and resource of the week. Actually, we're going to dispense with our tip of the week this week because in lieu of a tip, we're bringing you instead some troll-related entertainment of the week. One courtesy of one of our listeners, viewers, Stian Skarsbo Solheim from Oslo, Norway, which he points out is the land of the original trolls. In reaction to our episode last week with Lee Cheng and our discussion of patent trolls and the don't settle sentiment that Lee expressed and the t-shirt that he makes available to not feed the trolls. We were pointed toward the Rudyard Kipling poem about Danegeld, I believe is how you say it. And the whole concept of Danegeld, which was tribute that you would have to pay the Vikings. Otherwise, they would come and sack you. So if you didn't want to be raided and ravaged by Vikings, you had to cough up. And Kipling wrote a great poem about that concept. It is concluding with the following stanzas. It is wrong to put temptation in the path of any nation for fear they should succumb and go astray. So when you are requested to pay up or be molested, you will find it better policy to say, we never pay anyone Danegeld, no matter how trifling the cost, for the end of that game is oppression and shame, and the nation that plays it is lost. So thank you from Norway for our wonderful bit of troll related entertainment. And then I forgot to ask the studio to go ahead and cue this up, but hopefully that has been done. This is something Shenny Chardin pointed to over at Boing Boing by Jonathan Song A Day Man, who I had not come across before, but he did a wonderful song about patent trolls, and I was hoping we could play a bit of it here.
Making anything except paperwork. If it's real people making things that you heard. If your office is a broom closet somewhere in the state of Texas, we'll all line up in a big row to punch your solar plexus and destroy.
What rhymes with Texas?
That's great. The whole thing definitely deserves your attention. It's quite a funny video, and Shenny's right. It's just worthy of being adored. So please go adore it. We put a link to that and everything else that we've discussed today in our links for the show at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/230. So go enjoy Jonathan's Song A Day Man. Looks like he's got quite a bit of entertaining material over there. And then for our resource of the week, something from Professor Goldman, also from his Forbes blog, that I thought people would be interested in on any number of levels. He's got a piece that he authored about co-authoring a casebook. The casebooks are what you use in law school to they're your reference books for your courses. And he and Rebecca Tushnet wrote a book on advertising and marketing law. Now, when I went to law school, we didn't have ebooks. I imagine that today there may be more than just Professor Goldman's and Tushnet's ebook that is in, it takes the form of a casebook. We used to have to carry around, you know, I mean, these things would weigh 8 pounds a piece. So it's just a blessing, first of all, that casebooks are being made in ebook format to begin with. But what Professor Goldman did here is discuss their decisions about making the book, their pricing of the book, which is terribly, terribly cheap. It's a DRM-free PDF, and it's $10. So if you're interested in advertising and marketing law, you're going to find all kinds of wonderful discussion of it in their book. And so that's one reason to highlight it as a resource of the week. The other is to go through the whole process about the economics behind the book. If you're someone who's interested in self-publishing and the best way to do that, there's some great discussions here. If you're someone in academia who's considering doing this, great considerations in Professor Goldman's article. So definitely go check it out. And again, they're not in this for the profit, but a $10 casebook, whether it's in ebook form or otherwise, you know, I would go bankrupt at the beginning of every term in law school, having to buy all the casebooks, which were nowhere near $10 even back then. So more power to them for doing it in this way. And I envy all the folks in law school today who get to both learn from people like Professors Goldman and Tushnet and have this kind of material to work with. Evan, wouldn't it have been great if you could just put all your casebooks on a Kindle or iPad or a Nexus 7 tablet?
Right. That would have made a huge difference. You know, I mean, the thing I like about ebooks is it's great. It's a great way to, if you, you know, highlight and make annotations, notes in the margin. It's a great way you can easily bring them all together in one place. So I think that would have been the most useful thing for me, having ebooks in law school, you know, notwithstanding the obvious great factor of not having to carry these things around. And those darn things are expensive. You know, I teach, you know, at a class now in law school, and the text that I ask my students to buy is like $78. And it's just, you know, like a 150, 200 page paperback. So I really have a weight on my conscience asking my students to spend that kind of money. And so I'm certainly looking for alternatives. And this is inspirational in that regard.
Yeah. And the fact that it's DRM free makes it easy to do what we used to, you know, we used to copy, which I'm sure, you know, there were restrictions against that we just ignored, copy pages out of the textbooks and reassemble them in outline form, you know, in a very old school paper and copy machine kind of way to be able to study for exams. And I'm sure being able to cut and copy and paste out of the casebook is hugely beneficial to students when they're trying to get ready to be tested on the material. So check that out if you are interested in advertising and marketing law, which is, of course, what Professor Goldman's blog is nominatively all about, although he discusses so many other things there too. We have been thrilled to have him on the show this week and to have David Green join us from EFF. David, so much great stuff going on, as always, at EFF. We're thrilled to have your firsthand update on the First Unitarian case and on everything else we've discussed today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yes, we'd love to have you on again. Looks like you're on Twitter. We did not put your handle up, but if folks want to follow David on Twitter, he's David Green over there with an E at the end. Anything else you want to let our viewers and listeners know about stuff they should be checking out at EFF or things in particular that you're working on?
Yeah, well, just check our website all the time. We're always posting new things at EFF.org and trying to keep that current with all the cases we're working on and trying to blog about all these issues as they come up. You know, we're with all the stuff, we're finding out new things about the NSA surveillance every day. We're trying to keep current, and we have some really great resources on our site about trying to make sense of and piece together everything we're learning about NSA surveillance. So I would encourage you all to look at that.
Great. We will continue to do that. For those of you who've joined us live today, we're really grateful for that. We love having an audience while we do the show. If you're one who likes to watch live, you can catch us live on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. Jump on into our IRC if you're going to do that at irc.twit.tv during the show. But if you can't make it live, don't worry about it. The show's going to be there for you on your own time in an on-demand kind of fashion. If you go over to twit.tv/twill, our whole archive of shows is there, as well as if you're a YouTube person, we've got a channel over there at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're on Roku and in the iTunes store, so however you like to have these things distributed to you, we're going to be there for you. If you have a way that you'd like the show distributed that we're not hitting on, or there's anything else that you'd like to discuss with us, please email us. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. We love hearing from you between the shows with your Kipling poems or any other ideas that you might have as feedback to what has already gone by, or suggestions of things that we might want to talk about or guests we might want to talk to. Please do get in touch with us either in email, hit us up on Twitter. Evan is Internet Cases over there. I'm D Howell. And we also have pages on Google+ and on Facebook for the show. So we love hearing from you. We couldn't do the show without your help. We wouldn't want to. It's a very interactive kind of experience. And we have busy lives that prevent us from paying attention to every little single thing that happens during the week. So you guys really keep us up to speed. And we appreciate that. Evan, anything you want to say in closing?
No, fun conversation. Really enjoyed. Glad we could talk to Professor Goldman. And David, what a pleasure to meet you. Really have enjoyed being able to talk to you and learning more about the great things you're doing at EFF and at large. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and we followed the Benner case with such enthusiasm when it was going on. So it's great to be able to meet the pivotal person behind that. Were you at Brian Cave at the time that case was going on?
Yeah, when I worked on the Bunner case, I was at an organization called First Amendment Project, another nonprofit organization. So, and working with EFF on that case. So that was a long time ago, though.
Yeah, that was the dark ages, wasn't it?
It was. I was wondering.
Still use DVDs.
Yeah, that's right. And decrypted them too. I was wondering, was it ever a fact in that case? I have it rattling around in my head that somebody put DCSS on a billboard. Did that ever happen?
Well, you know, one of the arguments we were making there was that, you know, in order to use the Uniform Trade Secret Act, you actually have to prove it's still a secret. And we had said, well, it's not a secret anymore. You know, someone put on a billboard. People had on T-shirts. Actually, we're going to wear the T-shirts to the court. You know, and they just. And so that was, you know, all that stuff was just supporting this idea that this was that the secret. That it was the secret was out. It actually took us quite a long time to get to that position. Just the way the case developed, the courts didn't seem to be that concerned. They were willing to just, you know, assume it was a secret for quite a while into that litigation. So.
Right. All right. Well, we need to wrap things up here, but it's been a really fun show. We hope you've enjoyed it too, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Law.